If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
But actually, the situation is infinitely more complicated as ever than the perception you might have about it. So it's not Scotland versus England, it's not Catholics versus Protestants. Charles is not a Scottish nationalist hero by any stretch of the imagination.
That was Jacqueline Riding discussing the Jacobite Rebellion.
Says the people of this country, of the West, are all tall and honest. And then it goes on to say, in fact, in that, they're quite like us. These are decent people.
And that was Michael Scott talking to us about connections in the ancient world.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to our fourth podcast of July 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with Dr. Jacqueline Riding of Birkbeck. She's the author of Jacobites, A New History of the 45 Rebellion, which, as the title suggests, describes Bonnie Prince Charlie's attempts to win back the throne for his family from the Hanoverian dynasty. Our book's editor, Matt Elton, spoke to Jacqueline recently and began by asking her about what point in the Jacobite story her book begins.
Well, I think you can't really do the 45 without starting reasonably early. I mean, the first chapter obviously has to deal with the backstory of why did the Jacobites exist at all? Who are the Jacobites? So you have to start really with the Glorious Revolution as it's described. So this sort of 1688 onwards. And I tried to get that over and done with as fast as possible, because if anyone knows anything about the story, they want to get into the action. They want to get they want to meet Charles, and they want to get going on this extraordinary story. So you have to start in the, well, you can start as early as you like in the 17th century, but you know, you have to do the latter part of the and the reign of James the Second and Seventh, and then you rattle through that, and then you can really get going on the 45 itself, which really starts as a campaign, starts in 1743. So I also wanted to start the story, once you've got the back story described, I wanted to focus and start on Rome itself and the exiled Jacobite court. So the story would fast forward from the background to these individuals, in some way trying to describe James Francis Edward Stuart, who's the old pretender, the son of James II and VII, and so on. So you want to get a sense of their character, what it's like being in an exile court, how difficult it must be to, as I call it, maintain sort of battle readiness, as it were, for the potential, you know, within a number of days, weeks or so, to actually form the core of a court back in London, in Britain, should a restoration attempt be successful. So I wanted to, so initially I rattled through the past, the history, to the 45, and then really sort of settle in and get going around 1740 onwards, and really get going in 1743.
So by the time we get to 1745, who are the key players in this story?
Well, obviously a key player, and if you were doing a film on this, one of the leads would be Charles Edward Stuart himself. So he is obviously the son of James Francis Edward, the old pretender. He has been sent in 1743 to four, at the turn of those years, with the blessing of his father to Paris, in order to head up an invasion attempt. Which is being supported, effectively, an evasion attempt by the French. So the initial part of what we could call the 45 actually is with his father's blessing, and it's an official attempt by the Stuart court with the old pretender very much for it. And his son is sent as the representative of the Stuarts to Paris to head it up, as I say. That then fails. Charles then ends up kicking his heels in Paris for over a year. So the 45 includes this amazing period of a year where he's trying to get support, get the French back on side to attempt another invasion of Great Britain, whilst there's fighting in Flanders as elsewhere in Europe. So the two leads, the key leads from the Stuart point of view are is James Francis Edward Stuart, who's the old pretender back in Rome, and his son Charles Edward Stuart in Paris. You've also obviously got Louis XV of France, whose support is crucial to any attempt or indeed successful Stuart restoration attempt. So they're the three key players right at the beginning of the story when Charles is actually in Paris. And then, of course, he, through frustration, he decides to, because there's no obvious major invasion occurring through the French point of view, from the French point of view, he decides that he's been pushed too far, and that he really has to do it himself. That, in fact, he's going to force France to do what he wants them to do, which is a major invasion of Britain, probably the southeast and Scotland at the same time, tens of thousands of soldiers, transport ships, bullets, the whole thing. He thinks if he can do a sort of low-key attempt on Scotland, hit the ground, get the supporters together, and then start the campaign, France will see that he's serious, and then they will support him, give him the full support that he needs. So that's the position in June 1745.
What traits of Charles's personality do you think allowed him to be in the position that he was? Do you think there were things that made him good at his role?
I think it's almost more basic than that. I don't think his life has a lot of meaning unless an attempt to restore the Stuarts is either in train or is in action. And I think that's how he feels. If you're trying to get into the head of that individual, I think that would be a key thing to understand about him, I think. He's spent 24 odd years in Rome hunting, waiting for something like this to happen. And I think in other words, that's the basis of his decision-making, is that this is the point of his life. This is his purpose. And I think he also, with his father, believed that there are potentially, hundreds of thousands of people who think the same way. They are waiting for the Stuarts to come back. So in that sense, he feels he has a very clear view of his role in the world and what he's here to do, and that is to restore the House of Stuart. So I think that's key to his personality. And I think he feels that, you know, when he's been in, as I say, been in Paris for over a year, Louis XV has refused to see him. They're keeping him incognito the entire time. And as James Francis Edward, his father back in Rome, says, you know, what does this mean? This keeping him on the quiet, on the cheap, obviously at hand, so that should they decide to ruffle the feathers of the king in London, they just sort of prod, you know, Charles into action and says, look, we've got the young pretender here, you know, to in some way sort of disrupt and disturb the government in and the king in London. So Charles decides that in order to pursue the very purpose of his life, he needs to take the reins himself and do it himself. So I think he's a very persistent, I mean, can you imagine spending all that time in Paris simply waiting for somebody else to burp into action? When this is your purpose, this is your life, and people want you to do this. This is how he feels. This is what he thinks. This is, you know, his godly right is to be the heir of the, you know, the Prince of Wales, of Great Britain and Ireland. And Louis XV, who obviously has other things on his mind, mainly, you know, the what's good for France, you know, has shown himself to be a somewhat sort of, you know, half-hearted supporter at times. And so he says, right, I'm going to grasp this nettle. I'm going for it. I think because he never expected to, by himself, with a few men, you know, and a couple of guns and some cannon, to succeed. Because, you know, as we know, invading and then pursuing a military campaign, you know, a coup in Britain is not an easy matter. I think he genuinely believed with enough, with the wind behind him, you know, with in his sails, etc., with enough people to show that there is a genuine support for the Stuarts, active support for the Stuarts in Scotland and then Great Britain more broadly, that France would stir itself into action and throw its full weight behind the campaign. So I think he was trying to, you know, call France's bluff. You know, you want us back on the throne, you get on with it, you do it. So again, I think it's quite, you can kind of, you, if you think of it in that way, I think you can understand what he does and why he does it. So I think, yes, cut a long story short, he's a very persistent, focused individual. But he's also, in order to succeed, you have to be charming. You have to have charisma. You have to have a reason for people believing in you and, you know, and loving you, as he would expect from his loyal subjects. And so he must also be, and people do write about it, that he is charming, amusing, you know, all the things that are prince of the Ancien Régime would be expected to be in regard to his sort of his interpersonal skills, as it were. I suspect, and in fact, people do comment on the fact that his education isn't quite what would have been, again, expected of a prince of this period. I quote comments from a variety of different people that meet them and say that both princes, both he and his brother, are charming, you know, elegant individuals, but they just don't seem to have as much wit as you might hope, and an awareness of the world, let's say. So I think that would always have gone against him. But I think the basic character traits that he's got is what drives him forward and takes him a very long way indeed.
Mm. And certainly through to the September of that year, they did seem to have the wind behind them, didn't they?
Well, I think they had the element of surprise on their side, isn't it? It was the chutzpah, wasn't it? It was the, you know, turning up, you know, being very persuasive. People, you know, with a natural loyalty to the Stuarts, you know, like, you know, Lochiel and people like that, all, you know, despite their better judgment joining, you know, with that kind of momentum, they got all the way to Edinburgh. They obviously got the Battle of Preston Pans in the September, which against all the odds and everyone's expectations, they succeeded. It's a victory, a Jacobite victory. And all of a sudden, there's a powerful thing there. Not only is the momentum behind them, but the PR's behind them too. They've beaten one of the best trained armies in the world. So, or at least a contingent of that army. But nonetheless, you know, the reputational benefit of this is massive. And if you've got something like that behind you, a major victory, you've occupied the capital of Scotland. Okay, you haven't managed to take over all the forts, the garrisons and forts and so on, or indeed Edinburgh Castle itself, or Stirling. But nonetheless, you know, that's a great first, you know, great start. And that can only be of benefit to the people sitting in England waiting to see what's happening before they join in. Surely all that success in Scotland is going to generate a huge amount of support, you know, a whole wave of support behind the advance to London.
Is there a point at which we can say that things began to start going wrong, or is it too complex to say that?
I can say one thing outside of the book, because the book was written, you know, the one thing I did not want to do was to start the first chapter by saying, this is doomed, and now I'm going to tell you why. Who wants to read a book of the doom, the romantic doom and gloom of the last Jacobite rising? No one would want to read that. So I wrote the book as if you have no idea what's going to happen next. You know, it's a bit like watching Macbeth, a really good production of Macbeth, where you get to that moment, you think, maybe he won't kill Duncan. Maybe it isn't that downward spiral of, you know, doom. Maybe it's not a tragedy. And I was hoping that as people are reading it, they think, well, I know what happens, but maybe it doesn't, that somehow you're carried along. So it's kept in the moment, as it were, rather than a retrospective history where you're constantly being reminded of what happened next. You're hopefully being taken along, so you're not quite sure whether your memory of what actually happens is right or not. So stepping outside the book, which I absolutely intended never to be, you know, the death of the Jacobite cause, because nobody would have known that, even in 1748, well after the Battle of Culloden and various other things. I wanted it to be kept alive, as it were, as much as people at the time believed it to be or not. But stepping outside of that, I think the fault lines started appearing almost immediately within the Jacobite command, which was crucial. You know, whether these guys got on, you know, the heads of the various regiments, whether they be the Highland clan chiefs, or whether they're Irishmen who have experience of being in a regular army, the keeping that group together and focused and unified and behind the campaign, or rather from Charles's point of view, behind what he thought the campaign, what the aim was, which obviously is the Stuarts being returned to all their territories, you know, the Great Britain and Ireland, and in fact being resident in based mainly in London, but occasionally coming back to Edinburgh and so on. If everybody's behind that, then of course you can move mountains. But if they're not, if the fault lines already exist, which they did, then it's a massive issue and a massive thing for a character, a young character, inexperienced individual like Charles Edward Stuart, to balance, to cope with. So yeah, so I think from the kind of not that that would necessarily have foretold the failure of the campaign, but it certainly didn't make it any easier to maintain the discipline that they needed, the union, the unity of focus and aim that was required. There was a disjuncture almost from the onset between various camps, which just got worse and worse and worse as the campaign went on. So I think you could see problems early. But, you know, if the campaign had been successful, you know, and the Stuarts had returned, then we'd look back on that and say, well, despite the fact there were these issues, you know, they still managed to do it. So I think in retrospect, you can see the fault lines early.
For people who may not know, what happened into the opening months of 1746?
So what's happened is that you've got this extraordinary advance. The Jacobite army, which by the time it leaves Edinburgh, in the beginning, end of October, beginning of November, is about 5,500, 6,000 strong. Advance into England, they just keep going. They through the northwest, they go through Cumberland as it was then. They advance through, they go through Lancashire, and then they get all the way to Derby, which is famously 120 miles from London, and then they retreat. So by the time we get to, and retreat successfully back into Scotland, because there's another Jacobite army forming in Scotland, a second army, as it were. And the idea is that that they can't advance any further than Derby. They feel they're going to be cut off from this second army back in Scotland. And what they need to do is to unite the army, so it's almost double its size, consolidate their successes in Scotland, and then potentially advance back into England. So that's one potential forward thing. So by the time we get to 1746, early 1746, in the January, you have a sizable Jacobite army. It's not all gloom and doom by any stretch. And it wins yet another victory at Falkirk. So that's what's happening in the January of 1746, at the turn of 45-46. So in other words, this is an army that's not, in decline. It's not a cause that's desperate and on its knees. As I say, with this idea of never quite, the book never shows you what's happening too far in advance of where you actually are in the story. At that moment, after the Battle of Falkirk, that's, again, another experienced general, Henry Hawley in this instance, is beaten by the Jacobite army. So this is an army with its tail up. And then, of course, you've got this—the move towards, the slight cat and mouse thing that goes on in Scotland. As in fact, rather than consolidate their success by attacking Hawley's army again after Falkirk, in fact, it's decided to retreat further into the Highlands in order to winter out, as it were, the months. Months in front, and then come the spring to be in full strength to then meet up with the British army again. So that's the thinking, more or less. I mean, Charles is not happy about what happens after Falkirk, that the fact they don't follow up the victory at Falkirk with the annihilation of the British army that's there, that they in fact, as far as he's concerned, retreat. And he's certainly not happy with that. But it's seen as part of a kind of longer game from the Scottish commander, mainly Scottish commander's point of view, to retreat back into the Highlands and to sort of build up the army, maybe with some training to make sure it's fed and so on and so forth. But, so there's a kind of logic in what they do. So that's the situation in the first 3 months of 1746.
How do you think the specific events that unfolded in April 1746 have made it so legendary, so influential to later history?
Well, I think once you know anything about it or you read about it, you realise that, in fact, Culloden didn't have to happen. It didn't have to happen on that day. Charles, is one of his main commanders, Lord George Murray, argued for the rest of his life that they just didn't need to make that stand at Culloden on the 16th of April. You've also got, from the legendary point of view, you've got the failed night march, whereby the thousands or so of the army that actually happened to be in the vicinity, because many of them were off trying to find food and so on. So there was a sizable group of the Jacobite army was at around Culloden, around the Culloden house. And the British army had advanced to Nairn and was encamped at Nairn. And the Lord George Murray is always credited with suggesting it, but it seems to have been something that had been kind of worked out. And he definitely he felt it was the lesser of two evils, was to advance at night the entire army to the encampment at Nairn, the British army encampment at Nairn, and to attack the army in their tents, in their beds, as it were, and to get rid of the British army in that way. And if they had done it, it would have been an extraordinary manoeuvre, which would have completely ruined the British army's chances of fighting and being succeeding against the Jacobite army. So I think what's so legendary about what happens in April is that there are there are so many potentials, or a potential, at least one potential of great success, which if it had come off would have completely changed the entire history of Great Britain. But sadly for them, that particular attempt to sort of annihilate the British army in their beds, in their tents, failed because the Jacobite army didn't leave early enough from Culloden. It was a good sort of eight or so miles march in the dark across boggy, you know, lumpy terrain. And they just didn't get there in time to make the surprise attack in the dark. In fact, the sun was coming up and it was in more or less broad daylight by the time they were within a couple of miles of the British Army camp. So I think this all feeds into this what-if element of the 45. There's lots of, I don't know if it's that rare amongst pieces of British history, but there are lots of what-ifs for some reason within the story of the 45. What if they had advanced from Derby? What if the night march has succeeded? You know, it just seems to be that then that kind of builds on that idea of the legend and of this particular campaign.
Are there any characters in this story who you think haven't otherwise got the recognition they deserve?
You've read the book, so you could probably tell who I have slight fuzzy feelings about, warm fuzzy feelings about. One of them would be, I think he's one of the great heroes whose name is not necessarily well known, certainly south of the border, is Duncan Forbes, the Lord President, who comes across as such a sensible, even-handed, you know, very clued up politically, legally. He's obviously on the Hanoverian side. His family are Presbyterians. So he wants to defend his religion, his denomination of Protestantism, particularly against Catholicism and so on, which of course the Stuarts represent as Catholics. But he's also very astute. His reading of what is the crucible of Jacobite support, of Stuart support, is the Western Highlands. And as somebody resident whose house, of course, is Culloden, ironically, Culloden House is actually his house, and the battle nearby was named after it. But he's, as somebody who's a proud Highlander and kind of lives, he's local. He understands and appreciates the stance of people who even are against his own political stance and so on. He has a deep understanding of it, inherent understanding. So I think if people had listened to him more, the 45 might not have happened. And after Culloden and the terrible devastation that occurs after that, His advice to people like the Duke of Cumberland and also the government back in London is, again, very even-handed. It appreciates that some form of justice is required. You know, if you raise a rebellion in your country and you fail, then there has to be something has to happen. But he feels that an extension of mercy is also very important and vital. And unfortunately, he's not really listened to. He's listened to in part, but not fully listened to. So I think I could highlight one individual that really should be better known, not just in Scotland, but I think more broadly in Britain, it would be Duncan Forbes.
How should we now see this story in light of 21st century political tensions and tensions about identity as well, I guess?
I hope that people will see that something that's often held up as very black and white. You've got your heroes, you've got your twiddly moustache villains, you know, the Duke of Cumberland, for example. You know, Charles is the hero, Cumberland's the villain. That there's a obvious sort of, you know, there are virtue on one side and vice on the other. You know, there's self-interest on one side and honour on the other. I hope that if people read this book is to impress upon them that actually the situation is infinitely more complicated as ever than the perception you might have about it. So it's not Scotland versus England. It's not Catholics versus Protestants. Charles is not a Scottish nationalist hero by any stretch of the imagination. The breaking up of the Union, which the Stuarts used as part of their PR campaign to get those who were anti-union behind them for a Stuart restoration. I mean, that was something that they used, and in fact, Charles reiterates this in proclamations when he's at Holyrood in the September of 1745, that the union is null and void, and that the three countries that form the union, or rather the two countries, as in Scotland and England, this is now null and void, and they are now separate countries. So he, you might see him as being a kind of nationalist prototype figure, but it's a moot point whether once they'd arrived in London, whether Charles would have advocated the breakup of the union, simply on a basic level, because I, in my opinion, and I think others would agree, it would have been frankly easier to continue governing the Great Britain, Scotland, Wales, and England, via through the Union, through a single Parliament in London, in Westminster. So I think it's a case of some of the kind of things that have been attached to certain figures, particularly Charles and the Jacobites themselves. I hope that people will realise it's a lot more complicated than that, and that as I say, you know, no matter how charming the individual or how much you agree with their stance, most of the people involved in this, excepting the foot soldiers who have been dragged into this situation because of the right of their clan chief, a lot of the people involved in this are involved partly out of loyalty, but also out of self-interest. So it's just to realise that, in fact, life as ever is a lot more complicated than you might think.
That was Jacqueline Riding. Jacobites, A New History of the 45 Rebellion is out now in both the UK and the US, published by Bloomsbury.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And now it's time for the latest history news with our website assistant, Ellie Cawthorne.
Alongside surfing, skateboarding and climbing, another more unusual sport is being put forward for inclusion in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. English Heritage is leading a campaign to get jousting officially recognised as an Olympic sport. One of the world's oldest equestrian sports, jousting was particularly popular in the 15th and 16th centuries and was a favourite pastime of Henry VIII. The sport sees riders atop horses charging towards each other with lances at speeds of up to 30 miles per hour. English Heritage, who have launched an online petition in support of the campaign, already host jousting events across the country. Lucy Hutchins, head of projects at English Heritage, told The Guardian that the organisation is deadly serious about lobbying the International Olympic Committee to get the sport registered in the 2020 Games. Jousting is an incredible spectator sport, she stated. The skill of the knight and the horses make it a great thing to witness. We absolutely believe it deserves its place at the Olympic table. Sticking with English heritage, this week the organisation unveiled a blue plaque on the childhood home of footballer Bobby Moore. 50 years after he led England to victory at the 1966 World Cup, Moore has become the first footballer to be memorialised in this manner. He lived at the semi-detached house in Barking, East London, from his birth up until his England debut in 1962, practising his football skills on the surrounding streets. Moore's daughter, Roberta, said her father would be truly humbled and deeply touched by the plaque. In other news, archaeologists in Mexico have uncovered an underground water tunnel beneath the Mayan Temple of Inscriptions, a discovery which could alter our understandings of the Mayan belief system. Built in the 7th century AD, the temple was a tomb for the ancient leader Pakal. It stands on top of a natural spring, and archaeologists believe that the 2-foot-high water tunnel may have been constructed in order to transport Pakal's spirit into the afterlife. Carvings uncovered at the tomb also support this idea. Arnoldo Gonzalez, who led the project, reported that the carvings say a god will guide the dead towards the underworld by submerging them into the water so they will be received there. The discovery suggests that water played a more important role in Mayan beliefs about the afterlife than has previously been recognised.
Before our next interview, here's a reminder that tickets are currently on sale for this year's History Weekend events. They're taking place in Winchester from the 7th to 9th of October, and then York from the 18th to 20th of November. And both feature great lineups of historians, including the likes of Simon Sebag Montefiore, Dan Snow, Susanna Lipscomb, Anthony Beaver, and many others. Some of the talks are now beginning to sell out, so if you are planning to attend, then do book your ticket soon to avoid disappointment. You can find out more information and purchase tickets at historyweekend.com. Our second interview this week is with Michael Scott, a historian and broadcaster based at the University of Warwick. Michael's latest book, Ancient Worlds, offers a global perspective to our distant past, seeking to find connections between civilizations that are often viewed quite separately. I caught up with Michael a few days ago to find out more. Why do you feel that it's important to write about transnational history in the way that you've done here?
The EU referendum vote is on still on all of our minds. And it was interesting, I thought, that The Guardian around the 29th of June claimed that what the British vote represented was a rejection of globalisation. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. There is no way in our 21st century globalised world that we can sort of check out or decide to remove ourselves from the globalised world in which we find ourselves. And as a result, I think we need to take a new tack. I think we've seen globalisation too much as the enemy. And that's where writing Ancient Worlds comes in. What I wanted to make clear, as other books like Peter Frankopan's Silk Roads have done so brilliantly, is how much we owe to interaction with one another going back an incredibly long period of time. And whereas the Silk Roads tells the story, Peter Frankopan's Silk Roads tells the story of when the world is in permanent connectivity from the Mediterranean to China, Ancient Worlds, if you like, is the precursor to that story. It's the story of how we first came into contact across this vast geographical landmass from the Mediterranean to China. And I don't think there is a story more worth telling right now than one which looks back at the first moments of our interaction across such a global scale.
When we talk about ancient worlds, how far do these worlds stretch? I mean, are we including things like Africa, say, Northern Europe, maybe even Britain, where we are now?
Yeah, so what we've done in this book is looking from the Mediterranean, and that includes Britain as it's part of the Roman Empire, all the way through to China. We're looking at North Africa. What we don't do in this book is take a pan-global stage, if you like, and including Central and Southern Africa and the Americas. And one of the reasons for that is that the way in which the past has been written about in these different cultures, the way in which the archaeological research has been done, has left very different levels of texture and depth in these ancient times that we can get at these different civilizations with. And we are very fortunate in the area from the Mediterranean to China to have a pretty good texture and depth, which just can't be replicated if you go to Central or Southern Africa or to the Americas. And as a result, the way that I chose to write this book, which is to pick three very specific moments, we're thinking end of the 6th century BCE in part one, we're looking at the end of the 3rd century BCE in part two, and the 4th century AD in part three. To be able to talk about those kind of specific moments, what I had to do was to keep the book within the realms of the Mediterranean to China and talk about that story of gathering interconnectivity. But you never know. Maybe volume two might take us to the Americas and the rest of the world.
What would you say are the challenges of writing this kind of history? I mean, how difficult is it to work across so many different languages and different cultures?
Oh, it's absolutely a challenge. And I would never suggest that global history is the only way we should be doing history. But what I would say is that it should definitely be a more prominent part of the armory of the ways in which we approach the past. And I think the advantages that it gives you are threefold. The first is that it puts the emphasis on context, the wider global context in which each of these civilizations and cultures was interacting and functioning. And the second is that it prioritizes and gets you to think about how much these cultures owe to interaction with one another. And the third is that it simply gets you outside of the world with which you are increasingly familiar. And it's a way out of parochialism, to borrow a phrase from Sir Geoffrey Lloyd, who's a specialist in Greco-Chinese kind of comparative work. And I think that's incredibly important. We need to be reminded on a regular basis about what is familiar and what is deceptively familiar in the worlds that we study. So I think there are huge advantages. The challenges are obvious. You are having to throw yourself into worlds across a vast time span that have very, very different cultures and ways of thinking, and of course languages and different types of evidence that you can access. But what I've been incredibly heartened by on the journey of writing this book is not only kind of quite how possible that is to do, but actually quite how welcoming each sort of individual network of scholars have been, as I've discussed my research and my ideas with them, and we've talked about it, and how much they've welcomed that perspective that comes with the global approach.
We know now that the world is incredibly well connected in many ways. How connected were these various ancient world civilizations, and would it have extended beyond the spiritual and temporal leaders to the wider public?
I think so. I mean, very much so. A huge amount of the connectivity that we see in the ancient world from the Mediterranean into China was actually forged by traders, by those who were out there plying their wares and travelling across vast distances, or passing their goods on to the next relay of travellers who are taking it the next set of distances. Or indeed, as we see in part three of this book, when we're looking at religion, it is very much the missionaries, the practitioners of the religion, who are by nature very humble people, or indeed people from very noble birth who have given up their exalted positions and taken to the road as missionaries, particularly Buddhist missionaries heading east towards China. This was a connectivity that was fueled, if you like, by a very wide range of society. And the impacts of that connectivity, I think, would have been felt by a wide range of society as well. If we think about the Roman Empire for a moment, the number of goods pouring into the Roman Empire from outside the Roman world was huge, the most famous of which, of course, is silk. It was an expensive good, so it was something that only those with money were buying, but everyone knew about and was talking about. And so I don't think we can really underestimate the degree to which the connections had an impact on the individual societies, and indeed the role that a very wide range of the population played in fueling those connections.
I'm sure it obviously has varied across different civilizations, but how did people in the ancient world view people from other ancient cultures? Is it welcoming? Did they feel superior to them or scared of them or anything?
I think that's a fascinating question. And we're so used, when working in the Mediterranean world, to think about the sort of civilized versus barbarian dichotomy. The foreigners over there to the east are the barbarians, going all the way back to Herodotus, obviously, in the Persian invasions of Greece. But when you look at some of the first reports of contact from the west, further east, and from the east to the west, actually the note you get is one of respect. So from the west going east, at the end of the 4th century BCE, we have the figure of Megasthenes, who is the first official ambassador to be sent by the Seleucid rulers to the court of the Indian king Chandragupta Maurya at Pataliputra. And he writes his account of India as he finds it, his Indica, which is then recounted for us in part by writers such as Diodorus Siculus and others. And what's striking about his record of India is, on the one hand, you know, fanciful claims about ants the size of men and men who have their feet on backwards and things like that. But on the other hand, an incredible respect and admiration for Indian culture. He marvels, for example, at the fact that they seem to exist perfectly happily without slavery and that their society functions without much crime. And on the other hand, if you look at some of the sources from the East, from the world of the Chinese, looking west, particularly in document the Huanshu, the book of the later Han dynasty, in which there's a section on a chapter on the western regions, talking about the first people to make their way west. And the quote there is fascinating. It says, "The people of this country of the west are all tall and honest." And then it goes on to say, in fact, in that they're quite like us. These are decent people. And this is why that we have given the name to this far western realm, Dachin, the Greater Chin, which was a mark of huge respect coming from the Chinese world. So in that sense, it's quite a wonderful note, I think, that the first kind of records and mullings over of what the East is like from the Western perspective and what the West is like from the Eastern perspective is actually, in both cases, full of admiration and respect, rather than the more typical ones that we've seen over the centuries and which sadly are still present today of disrespect and of fear.
And as you mentioned earlier, you've picked out three key dates to focus on in your book. And the first one is in the late 6th century BC, where you've got great developments in democracy, religion, philosophy. How far do you think that these were actually connected to each other, or were they coincidental?
Well, I mean, the time around the 6th century BCE has been called an axial age, going all the way back to the work of Karl Jaspers following the Second World War, because you have this plethora of great thinkers and ideas that are born, both political and religious and philosophical, as you said, in this era. And so it is very tempting to see this as a sort of global turning point in human history. But what I'm specifically interested in this part, the first part of this book, is the political change. And there you have an example that in 508 BCE, Athens is in the grip of revolution that will lead to the invention of democracy. Rome is in the grip of revolution leading to the invention of its republican government. And at the very same time, on the other side of the world, you have Confucius thinking and developing his philosophy of just rule. Now, Confucius is acting totally independently from what's going on in the Mediterranean, although Greece and Rome are actually interacting quite heavily. And yet what it's saying, I think, is that societies are developed to a point of sophistication and complexity where they are being forced across that wide geographical span to face up to key questions about how best to govern themselves, how best to rule. And now they're coming up with very different answers because of their cultural contexts. But what's interesting, I think, is that they're all being forced to ask that question. And what other historians like Ian Morris in his book, Why the West Rules for Now, points out is that the end of the 6th century BCE is a fascinating moment in the human story, because unlike in the past where societies had got to a certain level of complexity but then collapsed under that complexity, actually this is the first time that they don't, that societies across the globe manage to develop solutions to be able to allow them to survive and indeed grow from this point forward.
Do we have any notion why that happened? What was different about this period?
I think to a certain extent, it's the evolution of radical ideas, the radical ideas that are suited to the particular circumstances of each particular world. What's striking is, for example, that in the Greek story, the invention and then growth of democracy, for example, is that you have an enormous number of sea battles. Now, sea battles are very important because everyone is rowing the ships. They are battles which reinforce the right of everyone someone across a society to have a role and a say in what that society does. If you would look to China, on the other hand, or indeed to Rome, you see an equal amount of war, but actually much more focused on land. And in land battles, you have a much more hierarchical system in which those that can afford the better weaponry or the horses tend to be more important to the battle. And so battles and war in those worlds tend to reinforce traditional hierarchies. So I think it's the evolution of radical and different ideas that are then supported by the particular cultural and historical and geographical circumstances of each world.
Second date you talk about is 218 BC. What do you feel makes this period so important?
I mean, I think 218 BC, which is made famous for us in the West with Hannibal sort of heading off across the Alps to attack Rome with his elephants, is the starting point for an incredibly important sort of 80-year period, if you like, a single lifetime. Because as Hannibal kicks off to challenge Rome for supremacy of the Mediterranean in the East, in China by this stage, you have just had the emergence of the first great unified Chinese empire, the Qin Empire. These two monoliths at the West and the East will come to govern half of the world's population and be stable parts of the geopolitical landscape for hundreds of years to come. And at the same time, over that next 80 years, you get the meeting in the middle in Central Asia. And I think this is a fascinating moment that the creation of the unified Chinese Empire in the East sets off a migratory wave of nomadic tribes heading west that are disturbed by the creation of China. On the other hand, with the war going on in the Mediterranean and with the Seleucid Empire running from the Eastern Mediterranean through to Central Asia, you've got continual challenges to rulership and the desperate attempts to reinforce empires and borders. And then in about the 140s BCE, so after about 80 years, you get the clash of those migratory nomadic tribes smashing into the Greco-Roman world in Central Asia, the very eastern edge of the Seleucid Empire. And that is the first moment that is recorded in both Western histories and Eastern histories. It is, if you like, the meeting of the historical record across this global scale. And it is the very beginnings of the permanent roots of connection from West to East that will become known famously as the Silk Roads.
And a lot of these cases, we're talking about war and conquest. How much were those factors important in bringing the world together alongside things like trade and religion?
Absolutely. I mean, I think war is a fundamental here, and particularly expansion from the East, not just the creation of the unified Qin Empire, but then when the Han Dynasty takes over, you see a very strong attempt by the Han emperors to expand westwards the sense of control, you know, to, in a way, protect and nurture these growing trade routes. But I think one of the other things that we can't underestimate is the way that once these networks of connection start, they become conduits, not just for the objects and people that are traveling, but also for ideas and ideas of all kinds and sorts. And that's why the part three of my book is fundamentally about religion and the spread of religious ideas across this now connected world. You have Christianity, of course, in the 4th century AD, spreading and becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire, but also spreading into places like Armenia, Ethiopia, further east. You have Buddhism spreading out of India up into Central Asia, but then fundamentally into China during this period. So I think it's important to realize that trade and war and power obviously are key starters in this mix. But once the networks are there, ideas of all sorts can move across them.
So you've picked out three very important years to frame this book around, but would it be fair to say that in almost any year you could find some interesting examples of interaction at this point?
I'm sure in any year there would be particular examples of interaction, or at least growing and gathering interaction. What I think makes these three moments particularly interesting is that they are a similar kind of development that is happening at the same time across such a vast geopolitical and geographical span. So it's politics for the Mediterranean to China in the 6th century, it's war in the end of the 3rd and early 2nd century, and religion in the 4th century AD. And for me, they are special and fascinating windows into the gathering connectivity of the ancient worlds that make up this landmass from the Mediterranean to China, which lay the groundwork for the centuries of connectivity along the Silk Roads and other trading routes that will follow.
To what extent do these connections that have been formed then continue into what I guess we'd call the medieval period?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. There are rises and falls. I mean, one of the most interesting connections, I think, is that those nomadic tribes that are fighting against the unified Chinese Empire at the end of the 3rd and beginning of the 2nd century BCE that will continue to plague the Chinese Empire for some time, as they start to migrate westwards, it's thought that the descendants of them are the Huns that will come to plague the Roman Empire in the 4th, 5th centuries AD. So in that sense, there are these wonderful global connections that continue to roll for centuries to come and will continue well into the medieval period, obviously with lesser and higher moments of activity and connectivity. And indeed, the Silk Roads will, you know, maintain their vivacity until you get to the era of Columbus discovering America, and you get to the era of when alternative routes by boat are possible. And it's only after that moment in the sort of 15th century onwards that you start to see the decline of the Silk Roads as the primary means of communication and connectivity across this vast geographical span.
Now, obviously, you're really keen to promote global history through this book, but what else do you think needs to be done by the history profession more generally to give the public a better idea of our global past?
Personally, I think that we need to be thinking about interconnectivity between cultures right from the get-go, the way we teach history at school, all the way through to university and beyond. I mean, I'm very heartened, for instance, by the OECD runs a program called PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment, and it's their job to look across 80 countries and see whether 15-year-olds are being prepared through the ways that they're being assessed for the challenges that they will face in the world today. And in 2018, which is the next PISA assessment year, they will, for the first time, be adding global competency as one of the key challenges that 15-year-olds need to be prepared for by what they are learning in schools. And I think global competency is defined as their ability to act as global citizens, their ability to engage with others, their ability to understand and think about cultures that are different from their own, and their ability to interact in a dignified and open way with people from across the world. And I think that's an incredibly positive and important effort to get behind. And I think historians can play an incredibly important role in that.
That was Michael Scott. Ancient Worlds, An Epic History of East and West is out now in the UK, published by Hutchinson. And in the US, it's available for the Kindle. And you can also read an article by Michael about global connections in our August issue, which is currently on sale. Also inside this month's magazine, there are articles on Eleanor of Aquitaine, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, a 17th century plot to kill Charles II, and the historical context of Britain's vote to leave the EU. You can get hold of our August issue now in all good newsagents in the UK and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And if you'd like to take out a subscription, we currently have a great deal available for new UK subscribers. You can get your first 5 issues for just £1 each. To take advantage of this deal, visit buysubscriptions.com/historymagazine and quote the code HTP206. One of the regular sections in the magazine, and on the podcast, is our First World War, which is following that conflict from a distance of 100 years, through the voices of those who participated in it. We've now reached July 1916, and here, speaking to the Imperial War Museum, is George Ashurst, reflecting on his experiences at the Battle of the Somme.
Over the top, you know, I'm on top then. It's partly blown down, you know, and I'm just stepping on top. There's a corporal lying there. Oh, and all his shoulders. All here was blown away, you know. And he looks up at me as I passed him. Go on, Corporal, he says, get the bastards. I remember that quite well. I don't stop, you know, I'm not to stop. I just said, okay, and buggered off as fast as I could, run, you see. That's what I did. Took no more notice of him.
Were you under a lot of fire?
Yeah. There seemed to be bullets everywhere. And I was zigzagging. I seemed to be dodging in between them. Must have been, anyway, to get there. And I dove in the sunken road when I got there.
How fast were you able to run with your equipment? Was your equipment holding you back at all?
It wasn't that. I was running fast. I was running fast, right enough.
Could you see what was happening, that there were casualties or...?
Oh, yes. And there was smoke, you know, gun smoke knocking about. You could hear him when a bullet hit somebody against you, you know. You could hear it hit him. You'd hear him groan and go down.
Was it mainly machine gun or rifle or artillery that was...
Well, I should say it was mainly machine gun that cut us up. Machine guns that cut us up. Yes, but far more so than shells, although I think this fella, this corporal I saw on top, I think he'd been hit with what they call a whiz-bang. There was a terrible shell, you know, it come like lightning to our trenches. And it was there.
Were you scared as you went over the top there? I mean, what were sort of things were going on in your head, if you can remember?
Just, I've got to get forward to on some road. That's all. I was dodging, you know, and it holding my head down like this, so a bullet would hit me tin hat. And I kept going. I don't know how I run there. I better run there anyway.
About how far was it?
About 150 yards, I should think. Yes. To that sucker. About 150 yards, perhaps.
So it'd be about another 75 to the German trench, if it was.
Yes. Yes. And you could, when you got to the sunken road, you couldn't see its trenches, you know. You were down below. When you left the sunken road at its side, the ground went up like that. You see, because when Colonel Maniac said, every fit man over the top again, you know, come with me, over the top, every fit man. Well, now, I don't know. I run up, but right enough, and run up the ground. Whether a lot more did, I don't know, or whether they disobeyed him, you know. But he went over. Whether a lot didn't, because when I dashed back into that sunken road, after I'd made my mind up I was no use where I was, on top of there in a shell hole, I found there were men in good order.
That was George Ashurst. You can read more from our First World War each month in BBC History magazine. And that is pretty much it for this episode, but please do listen in next week when we'll be talking about the Cold War and Greek philosophy.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.